medicine especially, and it's a three-year residency like anything else, pediatrics and medicine. But in those days, many people would have a one-year internship and go on. But I recall there was clearly clearly the message from faculty at the medical school, the full-time people, clearly the message there was times are changing, the scientific base of medicine is expanding, research is expanding, specialization and subspecialization is moving up to that time. Sure, there were specialists, there were surgeons and ophthalmologists, and that's orthopedic surgeons, but it was now more and more people were going to go into specialties, and pediatrics and internal medicine and OB were going to expand, and so the message I always got was get training now, don't go into practice. But I have to say, some of my classmates went into practice in the Albany area after a one-year internship. They've been very successful, and I assume have provided good care to their patients. But that, of course, has changed dramatically. But that was the academic environment. The school itself was in a mile or so from the area around the Capitol. And the Capitol was an old building, as I recall. And I
remember the hospital being not too far from the train station. Is this the one?
No, that's another one. You're thinking of a. Yeah, there is a hospital downtown. I'll think about it in a minute. It eventually did obstetrics.
What was the name of the hospital that you were involved in?
Albany Medical. It was called Albany Medical Center.
I thought that's where I went.
Albany, and right across the street, of course, the bigger hospital where we did a lot of our training was the Albany Veterans Administration, which was a fairly new, big hospital built, as you know, after the Second World War. The VA built big hospitals all over the country, but many of them were put on the campus or next door to the medical schools. And back in the early 50s, the VA made a decision to put its hospitals near medical schools and to have their physicians teach and supervise,
crossover.
As a way, it was thought at the time, as a way of improving the quality of medical care for the veteran. And because up to the Second World War, the few places that, as I understand it, that the Veterans Administration ran were old homes for soldiers out in the middle of nowhere.
Exactly.
They were in Nowheresville. Well, the VA in Reno started that way.
If they had anything serious that had to be done, they would
have to be
contract
shipped
to send them somewhere else,
right,
or contract with a local hospital.
But not the Albany VA. The Albany VA was built, it was very modern, built right after the war. And so when I got there, it had only been open a few years, and we spent a lot of our time over there. I learned, how to do physical exams and all that. But the old college, which was still there, and I haven't been back in years, so I don't know what it's like now, but gosh, I remember on the top of an old rickety third or fourth floor was where the anatomy lab was, and we'd go up this back stairs and up a rickety elevator to a old cadaver room with windows and... So talking about starting medical school,
antediluvian.
Yeah, that's what it was like. And a whole bunch of us lived very close to the medical school in a whole bunch of rooming houses, several of which had been bought and owned by physicians in town, and they would just keep rotating them. The one I was in, I think, had, I've forgotten, probably 10 or 12 medical students, usually two to a room. A tiny room like this, and we'd share a bathroom, and there'd be six or seven or eight medical students trying to get to school at 8 a.m, all using one or two toilets and and one sink to shave in. But at any rate, I can recall the name of the street was Quail Street, and there were a number of these rooming houses all next to each other, which had been old Victorian homes bought up by physicians and rented out to medical students. And the nice part about it, you just walked across a big park and a parking lot, and you'd be at school, and you could run to school in 3 or 4 minutes. But the school itself did not have any dormitories or rooming facilities. You got around town, and I lived in several of those.
Like the University of
Nevada. Yeah. So
you're on your own.
Yeah.
For housing.
I had never smoked a cigarette in my life. Never.
I'll bet you until, I know what it was.
And it started in
the anatomy lab.
And Dr. Jack Wolf was his name, was the professor and chairman of the Department of Anatomy. He was a chain smoker, and in those days, few of the cadavers were actually embalmed. Most of them were in vats of formaldehyde, and the stench got to you. So he smoked all the time, and he said, anybody who wants to smoke in the lab. So we started smoking mostly just to blow smoke into the around the cadaver while we were dissecting. And of course, it got to be a habit, and I did smoke then for another 8 or 9 years, and eventually gave it up. Yeah.
Yeah.
I can tell you later when the date I gave it up.
What was the date? Might as well tell me.
Well, December 5th, 1963, I was in Spain. I had just taken my board examinations. That's why I remember the date, because it's on my board certification thing. I'd taken my board examinations at Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C., and got on a plane. The Air Force sent me back, because I was in an Air Force hospital. Sent me back through, I guess, Wiesbaden. So I left Andrews Air Force Base, I guess, and flew to Wiesbaden. And I picked up the flu. I've been studying hard for my exams. And I got the flu, and I was sick as a dog all the way across the Atlantic. I thought I was going to die. Finally, after, and then it was a stormed in, so they put us down in at an air base in France, where I sat in a cold place for a day. Finally, after about 2.5 days after leaving Washington, D.C., I got home to Madrid. I was sicker than a dog. Went to bed, spent about, a week or 10 days, Celia nursing me. And during that period of time, of course, the last thing I wanted to see or look at was a cigarette. And that was it. I just stopped. I went back to work after I got over the flu, whatever it was, and never had a cigarette since, so I went cold turkey.
Boy, my experience in Spain was I had probably never seen so much smoking except when we were in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice that too, the heavy emphasis on smoking?
Yes, well, and it's...
At all age levels in
Spain? That was not so much the case when we lived there, but it certainly has become the case since, as a part of... women's liberation and women, we didn't see that. Women, a Spanish woman would never smoke in public
years ago.
No, wouldn't ever in public.
Uh-huh.
And the men used to smoke these terrible cigarettes, that where they got their tobacco from, I don't know. But then later in the 70s and early 80s, our friends told us it started. And now, of course, you go to any bar for tapas or any nightclub or any hotel, and the women are smoking even more than the men. But, you know, that's the same in Dublin. It's the same in London. The European, it's sad to see these beautiful Irish girls smoking cigarettes and beautiful Spanish girls. But so that wasn't the case in the 60s, but it certainly is the case now. But anyway, I smoked then from the first week I got into the anatomy lab in 1954, and I gave it up in 1963. So I regret now that I exposed my wife and my children to cigarette smoke in the house those years. Probably a couple of our kids had some allergies and respiratory troubles, and now that we know about secondhand smoke, I probably contributed to that. Anyway, I stopped, and I've never had a cigarette since.
So anatomy was...
anatomy...
Was it a setup similar to what I'm familiar with now here at this medical school?
Yeah, four people on a cadaver, and you dissected
the same cadaver
all Yeah, day? And you could... we had... And I think we had gross anatomy almost the entire year. We dissected mm-hmm. that cadaver all year long, every single sinew, nerve, bone, etc. And then, of course, we had neuroanatomy, which was mostly microscopic. And then we had biochemistry, which was nowhere as tough as it is today, although it was tough.
This was all in the first year?
All in the first year. And
physiology?
Some physiology. Yeah, we had physiology. And Dean Wiggers, who I mentioned, and a couple of his younger assistants did a lot of that. And it wasn't a very big class. We had, I think we had, I'd have to look it up, around 50 or 60 freshmen. We're all in the same classroom, all the same anatomy, a big, enormous anatomy. So they probably, what, four people to a table, maybe 12, 15 tables in this big, long order, big, long. It was one floor in the top of this building. And, of course...
Did you have any autopsies?
That would come in the second year. And
just as it is here?
Yeah, with pathology and microbiology and pharmacology. So it was a very, very standard curriculum. It was the classic post-Flexnerian, and it had been going on for 30 or 40 years. Everybody was lockstep. Everybody took the freshman courses, anatomy and biochemistry and physiology. The sophomore classes, they took pathology, microbiology, pharmacology. And then in the spring, the last few months of the second year, is when you take a physical diagnosis course or an introduction to clinical medicine, and we'd get rid of the white, the lab stuff, and put on a shirt and a tie and a jacket or a little white jacket, and usually go across to the VA, or right around the corner across the into the hospital at Albany, and start learning how to do histories and physicals.
So this was really your first contact with patients, starting around then? Did you?
The end of the second year, yeah. And as a matter of fact, I've often thought about that. Freshman year for me is a blur. I have very little recollection of it.
Were you happy?
No, I don't know if I was happy or sad or depressed.
Or just in shock.
Or shock, like many students, because we would go back and forth. We went to school on Saturday.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yes. Went to school Saturday till almost at 1 or 2 in the afternoon, maybe 1.
Wow.
And we were exhausted, but it was the traditional thing. You dissected that stuff and you memorized it all. So you'd go back to you'd have maybe, you'd try to eat some of the food in the college. They did let us eat in the, they had no college cafeteria. They let us eat in the hospital cafeteria where the nurses would eat. So, And the freshmen were always ostracized because, they'd walk into the lunchroom or the dinner room and everyone knew you were a freshman because you smelled of formaldehyde. And they'd say, well, you're a freshman. Would you please sit over there? And the food was fairly inexpensive. Very few people could eat out in restaurants, although we all used to go on Saturday night to Joe's Delicatessen over on, forgotten what that street was. Anyway, not very far from the school. And... that would be always filled with medical students because you could get soup and big sandwiches, filled with all sorts of stuff very inexpensively, and a big stein of beer or something, although I don't remember many people doing a lot of drinking. But freshman for me, it was a blur because we probably were sleep deprived, I don't know, stay up late hours studying, and then go to school in the morning, be there all day long, come home, take a nap if you could, or try to study or get something to eat. I don't recall in that time that exercise was a big thing, I mean, like it is today. We'd occasionally go out in the side yard and throw a football around, I remember that. We'd have some softball games occasionally.
You wouldn't have had much time.
There wasn't much time, and there wasn't... I don't recall people getting on bikes and riding and running. Jogging was not in. None of that stuff.
Well, you were right in the city, though.
Yes. So, I just recall the freshman year was one exam after another, studying, and I think part of it was my only joy was occasionally would Celia would come up for the weekend, or I'd go down to New York. Because we both were out of college the same year, and she was working at the Rockefeller in New York, I told you earlier, but living at home with her parents. So she'd occasionally borrow their car and drive up, and we'd have a weekend together.
You didn't have a car.
No, I never had a car until I was out of medical school. Never owned a car in my life till I was an intern.
Wow.
Couldn't afford it.
You didn't work.
I got a job. In the spring, working in the blood bank, they taught me how to draw bloods and taught me how to cross match. And then the only summer off I had, of course, was the summer between my freshman and sophomore year. So I did get a job driving a Pepsi-Cola truck. Because I had driven trucks in Alaska, the guy was willing to trust me, but also the wife of the owner of the local Pepsi-Cola plant had been a classmate of my older sister. So my older sister said, oh, I'll call, I've forgotten his name, I'll call him and ask him if he's got a job. Well, Albany sits south of Lake George and Saranac Lake and that whole area, and it's a big summer resort. So it's closed down in the winter, filled with snow, but in the summer, all these little towns and little places would open up, and New Yorkers would stream in for their summer vacations. Well, opened up would be little roadside stands that needed Pepsi-Cola and hot dog stands and restaurants that had been closed, or even hotels, most of them would be closed all winter long. So he needed extra help. So I got one of the routes which would take me up to Lake George. So I'd get up at, who knows when, 5 o'clock in the morning or 6 and go to work and drive these trucks, you know, and unload crates of... But I also worked inside. I learned how to run a bottling plant thing. And then I had no way of, I got through my freshman year because, and I wanted to say this for the record, my older sister and older brother gave me the tuition. They said, we'll give you the tuition for the first year because we know it's important that you don't worry about eating and we don't worry about the tuition and that you can do as well as you could.
There were no scholarships now.
No, and I don't think the medical school gave scholarships. I mean, you paid tuition. I don't think there were, not at this point. So they
student loans, that kind of thing that our students survived on.
There was no such
thing.
No, well, there might have been, but
you were a veteran.
You could have probably gotten them as a veteran, and maybe you could have gotten them from a local bank where your parents did business or something. But it wasn't a big deal like it is now. Mm-hmm. And I frankly don't know how many people paid for it. I know that my sister, the older one, who was a school teacher, had a good job, and at that time I think she was overseas in Indonesia or Iran, one of those places. She gave me my tuition that year, and my brother, one of my older brothers, would send me money so that I could have money to eat and buy some clothes.
What's your older sister's name?
Evangeline.
That was it.
Yeah. And we'll talk about her later in my life. But so she was very helpful. And then both my older brothers would send me some money. And
What was the tuition?
Oh, I have the slightest idea. I can look it up because I've got it written down. I have it in my history. I can't tell you what it was. I have no idea what the tuition was.
This was open to anyone. I mean, you didn't have to be a state resident.
No, no, Albany is a private school.
Oh, this is private?
Albany is not a state school.
Okay.
No, it's not part of the state system. It's a private school. And as a matter of fact, it's still a private school, and the tuition is very heavy, like many other private schools. It's not a state-supported school, never has been, although it's in the state capital, whereas Syracuse and Long Island University, Buffalo, those are state schools.
And this Union...
That's private. Union
private.
University. It's Union University, and Albany's its medical school. But they also had, across the street from the medical school, was the pharmacy school, and they had the state laboratories and the VA. So it was all a medical complex, but the parent university was over in Schenectady, but that was private. So most of the, and many of the schools in New York State were private. Columbia, Cornell, Flower, in New York, those were private schools.
I gather that
Mount Sinai now.
I gather that you did well in grades the first year.
I did, yeah, I did okay. I struggled. I was probably in the lower third of the class because I was in. Remember, you know, when you get to medical school, the curve changes, it shifts to the right, and now you're competing with all the top students from college.
Mm-hmm.
And so the competition was considerably more. So And we've seen that repeatedly, even in our own school. I mean, it's well known that a lot of students come into medicine, medical school, who have been very good students in college, and all of a sudden they're put into a whole different competitive field, and all of a sudden they've gotten their first C or their first D, or maybe flunked a course, you know, or had to repeat a course.
Did you have any C's
or D's? I did in my second year. I'll tell you that story in a minute. The first year, I think I got all C's and B's. I'm not even sure. Well, I don't know. I'd have to look that up. But I was an average student, probably in the lower half or lower third of the class. And there were some very, very bright people.
You were always in a competitive situation.
Yeah.
Because you had to take an exam to get into high school.
Yes.
Or take any?
No, there was an entrance exam.
So you were competing with...
I competed for scholarships to Colgate.
Kids on your own level?
Sure, and then you had to take the MCATs, and, well, sure, it was always competitive.
So this must have been more of the same,
sure.
But with brighter kids, perhaps.
Yeah. Yeah, but as I recall, there were several, I don't remember how many, there were several in my class who were repeating from the previous year.
Really?
And at the end of my freshman year, there were several who had to repeat.
Really?
Oh, sure. So there was always, it was competitive, but there was no assumption that you were going to pass automatically. You didn't make the grade or you flunked a course, you repeated the year. You didn't just repeat the course because there was no such thing as taking a makeup course. You repeated the year, and I can think of several, two or three, who graduated, came with us, repeated the year, and graduated a year behind.
That's so tough.
And one of my friends repeated his freshman year with us. He had been there a year before. So there's usually two or three a year, I don't know exactly how many, who would have to repeat. Often they'd get dumped, or they'd lose from biochemistry, or they'd flunk the neuroanatomy course, which was very, very tough. As I recall, gross anatomy, it was just a matter of grinding it out. Mm-hmm. You can memorize 250 bones and muscles and all that stuff, but it wasn't. Yeah, there wasn't much conceptual stuff.
Yeah.
So anyway, I got through my freshman year, average as I say, got a job working for Pepsi-Cola. So the next question is, how am I going to pay for my second year? So professor of English at one of the local colleges who was paraplegic. He had multiple sclerosis. He had been in a wheelchair for a number of years. And he lived at a local hotel. And every year he would hire a medical student to come and live with him and be his companion. It'd always be a sophomore because you didn't know about it as a freshman. And besides, no freshman dared try to work. I mean, if you flunked your freshman year, you were in a lot of trouble. So... I remember talking to the fella in quite by accident in the spring of that year, sophomore, in the cafeteria, and he said, "I'm taking care of Mr. So and So, and I won't put his name on the record, and I'm leaving, starting my third year." And of course, you couldn't do that in your third year; you had to be available on the wards. Would you like a job? I know you need work. So I said, yes. I went down and interviewed with him. And halfway through the summer, this fellow started his third year. I had passed my freshman year and was going to start my second year. I already had the job with Pepsi-Cola, so I moved in, took that job around the 1st of August, and lived in the Wellington Hotel right down the street from the Capitol building. He had on the top floor a two-room suite, and he provided me with room and board for the year. I lived there 7 days a week. I would get him up in the morning, dress him, get him in his wheelchair, and then get myself dressed. I'd head off to school. Well, in August, I head off to drive in the Pepsi-Cola truck, but when school started in September, I'd go to school, get on the bus, and go up. It was a bus ride. It was a long walk, but usually I was late, so I'd take the bus. The bellhop from the hotel would come and take him down to the hotel dining room. He'd eat his breakfast. He'd be taken down for his lunch. Often, if I was late in the evening, the bellhop would take him down to dinner. But during the day, he would tutor. Students would come to his apartment, or his little apartment on the top of this hotel, would come to the apartment, and he would tutor high school kids, maybe some college, but mostly high school kids, in English, and they would pay him. So he had that, plus he had probably some disability. He had been married, but his wife lived in New York, and I think he had two grown children. He was a man probably in his 60s then. But I was his companion till the next spring, and lived there, took care of him, got him up every morning, 7 days a week, and would put him to bed at night, and I would shave him and bathe him, and essentially I was his caregiver. Yeah, it was an important experience. I'm not sure I know all the details of the diagnosis, but he had multiple sclerosis, but but how that progressed, I'm not really sure. But when I first met him, he had very poor upper body strength. He could use his hands and that, but he basically was paralyzed from the waist down. So that was my first.
Could it have been polio?
No, it wasn't polio. No. And it wouldn't act that way anyway.
Oh. How long had he been, though?
Probably had been that way 10 years.
Oh.
As I recall, about 10 years.
So
it came on as an adult.
Yeah, so he was able to get through college.
Oh, gosh, and he was a professor. He was a professor.
Before this set in.
Oh, gosh, yes. This set in when his late 40s, early 50s, as I recall. And so that was my first experience actually taking care of anybody. And it was a mixture of lifting him in and out of bed and on and off the toilet and in and out of the shower. And
pretty confining for you.
Yeah. And then, when I'd get him to bed, he would usually read for a while. I had the front room, which was a pull-out couch, so I'd pull out the couch, and then I would try to study. Well, for my studies, that was a disaster. I almost flunked out of medical school, but I made enough money with the Pepsi-Cola company to pay my tuition, and he paid me room and board.
Sure. And you didn't go home. So was that the first summer you didn't go to your mother's?
I didn't go home at all, no.
After that?
No.
You didn't go home after you started medical school?
Not really, no. Well, for a visit, for a weekend.
So you were off?
And the next year, Celia and I were married, so then
You know, you were off from June to September?
September of the first year.
Yes.
But I worked for Pepsi-Cola, and I started taking care of this man, and I did that until the next spring. Then, by somewhere around March, I was very apparent to me that I was going to flunk out.
This was your first year now, you're
No, second year.
Oh, we're now into second year.
Second year. I'm taking care of this man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to get my homework and read and falling asleep and then getting up in the morning. I'd have to get up at 6 to get him up so I could get to school, class at 8 o'clock. So it was apparent to me by about March that I was going to flunk, because a couple of the exams I just barely passed, and I was doing very bad in pharmacology. So I went to him and I said, you know, I appreciate this job, and it's allowed me to stay in medical school, and I'm not blaming you, but I'm going to flunk out if I don't. So he understood. I got another medical student who was doing quite well, who said he would come in and take care of him until we could get somebody new. And I think it was a freshman at the time. So we found another student. I left and went back to another rooming house near the school, moved in with a classmate. And it turned out that I did fail pharmacology. I took the final exam. I remember it very well. And there were whole areas that I was just didn't know a thing about. So the professor called me in, and several others, I wasn't the only one. In the second year of medical school at Albany at the time, pharmacology was considered the toughest course. The professors were the toughest, the concepts were the most difficult, pathology was sort of fun, but pharmacology was very difficult.
That's the first time I've heard that.
Yeah, it was very difficult. for us.
That pathology was fun.
Yeah, it was. I mean, well, the way it was taught was a very good person, and he made it meaningful, and he, you know, these are the diseases you got to know.
Did you have didactic type lectures?
Oh, tons of them, tons of them.
Through the whole three years, right?
But you still had to go back and look on the microscope. Mm-hmm. So I quit that job. I left him. I got another, then... In fact, I failed pharmacology. The professor called me in. There were three of them there, and there were three of us in the hallway. Each one of them had to go in, and they gave us an oral exam to see if we had frozen or had panicked or whatever. Did we understand, but we weren't? Did we know the pharmacology but didn't understand the questions? But whatever, and I did okay. But they said to me, I remember the words. Very well. The Dr. Ferguson was the professor of pharmacology. I've forgotten the other two fellows who were sitting there. They said, well, you are not very well versed. Better study, but since the school had accepted the national boards, part one as a condition of going on to the third year, and part two as a condition of graduating in the fourth year, they said, we will reserve judgment. We won't fail you or pass you, but you're going on to the third year and getting a C is dependent on how you do on the national boards. Well, Celia and I had already decided to get married the end of June. This is the end of May, middle of May. The national boards was given around the 15th of June, so I had about 4 weeks to prepare for the national boards, but it wasn't simply pharmacology, it was pathology and anatomy and all the rest. So to his credit, and always be grateful, my roommates, Steve Sullivan, who actually went into practice in the Albany area, he and I and another fella essentially quizzed each other day and night on all of the courses, but particularly pharmacology. And he was a pretty average student like myself. We studied day and night for those next 4 or 5 weeks after school got out for the national boards, because it was critical. First of all, they would have made me repeat the second year, and I probably couldn't afford it. I probably dropped out. But it was also essential that it pass. So, in fact, I did very well on the national boards. So did Steve. We worked. Literally, we would get up in the morning, we'd have breakfast, we'd quiz each other, have lunch, quiz each other, dinner, quiz each other till we fell asleep, and do the next thing we did that day in and day out. And of course, Celia and I had already decided to get married, and I kept having these terrible nightmares that if I flunk out of school, what am I going to do? I have no idea what I'm going to do. I guess we would have postponed the wedding, or who knows what would happen. But it turned out I did very well on the boards. I did okay in pharmacology, but enough to satisfy the faculty in pharmacology that I knew enough to pass. So lo and behold, I got my grades, forgotten when it was, not more than a day or two before we got married, which made my honeymoon very nice. So and I called up there and I talked to Dean Wiggers. He said, yes, we got your grades, we're going to pass you. I've talked to Dr. Ferguson, you will get a, and I think my record probably shows a D, although I don't know, I could have to look it up. Maybe that shows a C. But it was another kick in the ass that I guess I needed and got, not unlike, and it was deja vu all over again, according to Yogi Berra, German experience in college.
All right.
And it was critical. I somehow rose to the occasion. I wasn't dumb, but I certainly was distracted. I was exhausted.
There again is an understanding, helpful guy who could have easily just flunked you and said,
oh, yes. Yeah.
You're going to repeat this year.
That's right. And I never talked to him after that. He's now dead. I did talk to the dean after I graduated several years later, and they said, oh, yeah, well, we figured you'd make it, and we expected to be a good physician. But so what went on behind closed doors and what they perceived in me and several other classmates who were in the same boat, I don't think I told them The dean, I think, knew where I was working, because the dean's office would frequently try to get someone to work for this paraplegic, and he may have known what was going on in my life. The pharmacology people didn't. They just knew I wasn't doing the work, and I wasn't, I mean, not up to. But it was the same old story, you know, and I've seen it in other students in my life where, you know, they're struggling to try to make it, and they need
I've seen Dr. Sohn do that, and Dr. Malin, where you understood the student had such tremendous potential.
Right.
But there were other aspects of the
stress, pressure.
Remember the students whose parent died during that year, or they got married, or their wife had a baby, Richard Harris, a lot of these kids had great potential.
And a lot of, and I think in not knowing what went on in those discussions among the faculty, I think that's probably what happened, because but they put the monkey in my back. They said, "You do well on national boards, show that you know the stuff, and we'll let you go on." So
how did the class do on national boards overall?
I think. I'm sure I was down near the bottom of it, but
The class as a whole.
I think I think there was one or two that failed the national boards, and they had to sit out and retake them in the fall, like many. And as far as I know, I think the only people who had to repeat were the ones after the freshman year. I think everybody who got through the second year, got through the boards, went on. And then I really blossomed. Well, first of all, I got married on June the 30th. Celia and I got married, went off on our honeymoon, came back, and my junior year started the 15th of July. So we were gone 6 days.
Oh, then you started in July. You didn't.
Oh, no, you went right. No summer. Went right into junior year.
So the only time you had a fairly long break.
Between first and second year. Second year, you had a break from the end of the middle of May to national boards to study, but no one went anywhere. You studied. And then I had 2 weeks off after the national boards, like from the 15th to the 30th. Celia and I got married, had a nice wedding. We went, had a honeymoon for a week. Went to Bermuda, as a matter of fact. Her father gave us the honeymoon. It was very generous of him. And then we came back, went up to Albany, moved into an apartment that I had previously rented, put down a down payment. Cleaned it up, moved into an apartment, and Celia went to work within a couple of weeks, had already gotten the job, went to work as the secretary for the Dean of Nursing. Like many universities, medical schools, and colleges, there's always a turnover of secretarial jobs, usually every summer, because they're usually taken up by, at that time they were wives, and their husband would then leave, go on with their husband. So she got that job, and I had also applied for the Air Force Medical Student Program, which had just begun. The Army had one for a couple of years. The Navy had had one for a couple of years. In 1956, the Air Force decided, as a recruiting mechanism, they would take on a few junior and senior medical students, as the Army and Navy had, pay them as active duty officers, and then they would take, the student would have a commitment for extra years, because at that time there was a draft, there was the Berry Plan, and almost every doctor knew he was going to go in the service for at least 2 years. What I was going to do was obligate myself to 5 or 6 years in order to get an education. So I signed up, and in August of that year, I passed the national boards. I knew I was home free as far as that was concerned. And I was going from having only two nickels to knock together and working to get through the first 2 years, essentially, to now having a full lieutenant's salary every month in the mail, and my wife working, making a good salary. And all of a sudden, we had some money, so we could go out to dinner. You could buy some things, you know.
And you have a life.
And, of course, Celia was very good. She was wonderful. She's always been good to me. But she had worked hard and saved her money. So when we moved into this apartment, she had already bought a bed, a little sofa, a dining room set, a small little kitchen dining room set, had bought most of the accoutrements that we would need. And when she had had it in her basement in New Rochelle, to move up to Albany after he got married. And when the movers came, after we, or maybe while we were in our honeymoon, the movers came, and they started to take the piano out of the living room. And her father said, "Where are you going with that
my piano?
And I think it was Celia's mother, maybe Celia was there at the time, said, "Well, you bought that piano for me. I'm the only one that plays it," when I took my lessons back in the fifth grade or sixth grade. So we took that piano, and it still sits in that living room. It's a piano in that living room. We took it to Spain with us. We took it every place we went, and Celia's played it for 40 or 50 years.
Did they pay for it? And, they must have paid for the shipping of your things over to Spain,
Well, that was later. That was much later.
Oh.
But this was just taking stuff up to Albany at the end of our second year. So we moved into a nice two-bedroom apartment in an old Victorian house. We had the second floor, and there were some people living above us and below us. And it had a little closet had been made into a little Pullman kitchen, I guess, and there was a bathroom and a master bedroom, which we used as a living room, dining little thing. And then there was another little room off of that that we used as our bedroom. But all of a sudden, we had some money in the bank, and two checks coming in every month, and I really did blossom. I went from a average to lower part of the class to being really one of the better students in the third and fourth year.
Well, now you're out of that humdrum memorization period,
yeah, right.
And you're getting into your clinicals. Was the curriculum similar to what it is now today?
No, it wasn't. In that sense, but a part of my, I'm sure, thinking back, part of my interest in changing or altering and getting involved in the curriculum here and others like it around the country in the 70s was to get clinical experience early and to put our students in with doctors the very first year, which we did, to have patients right off the bat, to see, and that would probably, to me, was not only what was going on nationally, it wasn't unique to me, this was the trend going on nationally, but also my own experience of the first 2 years being so difficult, but also hard. The only patient I ever saw was the man I was taking care of, but I mean, we didn't see patients, we didn't, although we were connected to the hospital, the most we saw of the hospital was going to the dining room, to the cafeteria.
Sure.
And it was late in the second year that we began to do histories and physicals, and often we examined ourselves as not patients,
yeah,
although we did examine VA patients. So when I got out here at 25 some years later, I was determined to push for, and it was successful, push for early patient introduction, not to put down or denigrate the basic sciences or minimize them, but frankly to show that the basic sciences are essential to good patient care. But you got to see the two side by side. Yeah,
got to
see them side by side.
Yeah.
So anyway, I did extremely well in my third and fourth year. That was more or less where we have now. You'd spend 8 or 10 weeks in medicine and surgery and pediatrics and OB. There was no rotation in family medicine. There was no such thing then. And psychiatry and, but even psychiatry was mostly in a state hospital. And
Did you have that at the state hospital?
Oh, sure.
Where was the state hospital?
State hospital was down, about 30 miles south.
That's not Mattawan, is it, by any chance?
That might have been the name of it. It's south of Albany on the east side of the Hudson, north of Poughkeepsie. There's somewhere in there, there's an enormous big state hospital, which okay, now is probably empty.
The name Mattawan comes to
mind. I don't know. So we'd go there, and then we would do psychiatry in the local, they had a local closed ward. And so that was third and fourth years was fairly standard. Fourth year there was a fair amount of elective, and I spent some elective time in physicians' offices, but I was very good at that. I enjoyed it. I was happily married. Celia and I were no longer separated. We had money in the bank, so we could go to the dinner. We go to movies, sure. And our first son came along, Peter. And at that time, of course, Celia stopped working, but we were seniors by then. And So I was one of the runner-ups for a prize in medicine, but I did win the prize as the outstanding student in pediatrics, and got very good grades.
So it was starting to form already where you were going.
Yes.
In pediatrics. When did that start?
Well, it started in the third year, and as I suggested earlier, Mary Voorhees, talking about some women, Mary Voorhees was the resident in pediatrics at the time I was assigned to pediatrics. And in those days, the third-year medical students followed along behind the residents like little puppy dogs, and you did whatever the resident told you, and you didn't take anything independent. And she was just terrific. She let me do things. I think she taught me how to do spinal taps. She was very encouraging of me and let me do things. And like lots of other things, I think, personally, I respond better to honey than to vinegar, I guess. And so when I get positive feedback, and when I got positive feedback as a student, that just encouraged me more, and I worked harder. I don't believe in putting students down. Occasionally, a student has to be slapped behind the ear, I guess, you know, and figuratively speaking. But she was very, very good, and she was the one that encouraged me. And so when I left Albany, after 2 years, I did a lot of electives. Really,
where'd you go after Albany?
Well, we left Albany in the spring of 58.
Which was the end of your
end of my senior year.
Senior year.
Yeah, and I entered in 54 and graduated in 58. That's when I got my degree. But I had been in the Air Force junior and senior medical student program, getting a check every month, so I owed the Air Force time. Also, at that time, you had to get a special exemption not to do your internship in a military hospital. It was assumed and you agreed you'd do your internship in a military hospital. So when the match came out, which in those days was not a residency match, it was an intern match, just 1 year. After 1 year, it was a free-for-all. But you did match for internship. That started a few years earlier. So the match came out, and all I knew is that I was going to be matched to the Air Force, and they would assign me to one of their teaching hospitals. Well, the Air Force had no teaching hospitals in 1958. They didn't open Lackland until 60. So those of us who were in the Air Force program were assigned to either a Navy or an Army hospital. So I opened the envelope, and it said...